From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, November the 7th, 2019, and got a full and, I think, interesting show for you this morning. We're going to be talking in the first hour about access to the legal system for low-income Vermonters, and we have a new report out from a coalition devoted to that topic, made up of folks from the Vermont Bar Association, the Vermont Law School, the Vermont Supreme Court, and we'll be talking about that with a couple of guests in just a moment. First, I wanted to mention also that in our second hour, it is our regular Thursday segment these days. We're calling it Seeds to Society. We're putting it on in conjunction with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and they are coming in with a whole wide range of interesting topics to talk about. We started with using sheep to keep the weeds and grass down in a winery, bringing sheep in to mow your winery grass. That's pretty interesting. And I said, boy, we got to keep this going. So this week, the topic is, if you're raising backyard chickens, how do you make sure you keep salmonella at bay? Salmonella is always a threat when you're working with chickens. And what are the best techniques for making sure that if you have a little backyard flock that you don't get yourself or your family members sick? And it's very important stuff. So we're bringing in a couple of guests from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences to talk to us about that in the second hour. But this first hour, we want to devote to this topic of access to justice and the justice system for low-income Vermonters, particularly the civil justice system. And I want to introduce my guests. We have, I believe, on the phone, Aaron Jacobson of Vermont Law School. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Dave.
And in the studio with us, we have Mary Ashcroft. She's from the Vermont Bar Association. She is the legal access coordinator there. And our good friend, our regular legal analyst, Dan Richardson, is in the studio this morning. He just bopped in here about a minute and a half ago. And good morning, Dan.
Morning, Dave.
And we're so glad to have the three of you with us this morning. Talking about an important topic here, one thing is let's set the boundaries around it first. We're not talking about access to lawyers for criminal defendants here, right? We're this is all on the civil side.
That's correct. And, you know, I think it's a misnomer or at least a misperception in the public that, you know, we watch these shows where someone says, well, you have a right to an attorney. That's a very limited right. That's really for major felonies or felony criminal defenses, as well as in limited circumstances such as termination of parental rights. Most of the time, people do not have a right to have counsel appointed to them. They must hire counsel or they must go it alone.
And Mary Ashcroft, what is the Vermont Bar Association doing about this? And start with, this is a special, November is a special month related to all of this, right?
It is. The Vermont Supreme Court declared this month Access to Justice Month, and they are lauding the efforts of many of our colleagues in Vermont Legal Aid, in Vermont Legal Services, at the law school, at the South Royalton Legal Clinic, and at the Vermont Bar Association. Our lawyers, private lawyers around the state, have the opportunity to participate both as pro bono attorneys, which is lawyers for free, and as low bono attorneys, which is a program that we have started to pay lawyers a stipend. It's not very much, but we pay them to take certain targeted cases to help lower income folks in very important court cases to them.
Low bono. This is a coinage that's half Latin and half English, I guess. Is that the idea?
Yeah, we're pretty proud of that.
That's It really is as it sounds, folks. Of course, bono is Latin for good, B-O-N-O. And low is, I gather, just low cost, is L-O-W. And that's kind of clever. So
there's an interesting history. I mean, pro bono is a shortening of pro bono publico. Mm-hmm. For the public, good.
Yep.
But it's become, you know, sort of shorthand for any type of lawyer volunteer work. So pro bono work, you know, for the public good. So I think low bono is a portmanteau, you know, mm-hmm. a neologism that reflects mm-hmm. where we're going as a profession.
All right. In my more humble language, I call it a coinage or something. But that is important work because, I mean, let's face it, if you're paying sort of the standard going rates for legal assistance, you can be looking at $250 an hour or more, right?
Right. I mean, it can be expensive. And you know, we've talked among the bar, and some lawyers can't afford to pay legal fees. So, but we're aware that in the court system, there are some cases that clients attempt to do on their own. We call them pro se litigants. Mm-hmm. And there are certain types of things that have enormous amounts of people trying to represent themselves. A pretty common one is landlord-tenant cases, where the vast majority of people, tenants, trying to prevent eviction are representing themselves, and that's a difficult thing. The state judiciary says that 91% of the people and defendants involved in landlord-tenant cases are there on their own. And that's a case that we target and we try and provide representation. Collections defense, you know, credit card companies coming after people who owe money. 89% of the defendants represent themselves. Parentage cases in family court, 80% of the defendant, or 80% of the parties represent themselves. So there's a huge need for lawyers in there, and that's where the legal services organizations in Vermont try and help out.
And how I saw the phrase justice gap in the report, and I'm trying to get a handle on just how big is that justice gap. In other words, when the legal the low boner and pro boner lawyers step up and say, here's somebody with a landlord-tenant dispute, let's cover this case or handle this case for them, what percentage of those 9 out of 10 cases end up getting picked up? Or is that really the 9 out of 10 the result of just not enough? It's kind of where we are right now.
It's where we are. The folks at Legal Services Vermont say they get 24,000 calls into their hotline every year. And in my program alone, we cover 300 cases. So that's just our gap. Legal aid covers a lot of cases. And Aaron's going to talk about what the clinic at the law school does. But the gap is still there.
Aaron, talk to me about that a little bit. The law school, I gather, also the clinic there is doing similar work here, landlord-tenant cases, parentage cases. What other kinds of cases are you picking up down there?
Sure, thanks. So at the clinic, we work with law students on an array of cases. There are three attorneys and approximately 45 students per year. We focus on veterans cases, immigration cases, and domestic violence cases and cases for children. In any given year, we handle approximately 225 cases. We also do a lot of consultation, and that's where some of the other legal work comes in. We try to help people as best we can with landlord-tenant, collection defense, parentage cases, some of those other legal issues that we don't focus on directly, we still try to give people a fair amount of legal help and legal information. But in terms of the justice gap, another number is that we also refer 400 to 500 individuals per year to other legal resources. So those are all the people that we really can't help at all. And there's a number of reasons for that. It's human resources, but also it might be certain mandates from our grant funding. But that's we're basically not able to help twice as many people as those who we are helping. And that's just at our little clinic alone. That's just our clinic's justice gap. So, writ large across the state and across the country, it's enormous.
So you're basically able to, I had that when you talked about not being able to help twice as many people as you are able to help, I pictured someone only being able to eat a third of a pie or something. I mean, because I'm trying to draw a picture here for our listeners to understand in a very, fairly rough way, what the issue is here. And it sounds like there's just a giant unserved need out there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, like I said, we're three attorneys and a number of students at any given time, and we just don't have the ability to help everybody. We don't have all of the expertise that we would need to help people with all of the myriad of legal issues that, you know, that we take phone calls about. And then again, you know, we might have mandates from our funders about the kind of work that we should be focusing on. So it's definitely a complex issue. And that's one reason we're really excited about November being Access to Justice Month, because it gives us the opportunity to think about how we can try to address the problem, how we can close the justice gap. That's where we're at right now.
I wonder, is there I'm imagining a series of books like Be Your Own Lawyer for Dummies or something, where, you know, your issue right now is a landlord-tenant dispute. Your issue at some other juncture in your life is, worrying about whether you need to get an elderly parent declared incompetent and in need of care that maybe the elderly parent is resisting. I mean, there's just any number of possible legal issues that arise in the course of an average life. And I wondered whether... you do have any sort of standard go-to references where somebody calls you up and says, I have a landlord-tenant problem, and it could be solved by the person simply reading a pamphlet or a book. Mary Ashcroft, what do you got?
Well, I've got a couple of great resources. First of all, let me make sure I say the 800 number, which is the intake and the coordination of many of our legal justice programs in the state. So this is for Vermont Law Help. It is a program run by Vermont Legal Aid and Legal Access Vermont, and they send cases out to their attorneys, and they send cases out to their legal partners, including Aaron at the law school and me at the Vermont Bar Association. The number, 1-800-889-2047. Now, these folks also have a terrific website, and it's at VT, as in Vermont, vtlawhelp.org. And they can answer very much the questions that you just posed, Dave, about landlord-tenant, how do I get my security deposit back, what do I do when an elderly person in my family needs a guardianship. There's great resources there. You can also get over-the-phone legal advice by calling the 1-800 number again. That is 889-2047. And there will also be a screening to see if you're either a crime victim, in which case you may be entitled to an attorney to help you out for free, or if you are a low-income person, they will screen for your eligibility for one of the various programs that we just talked about.
We have a caller on the line, Jesse from Waterbury. What's going on, Jesse?
Thank you, Mr. Graham. I appreciate your services. And I'm calling today to talk to Mary, just ask her a quick question about community gardens and the legal rights that people have when they're working in them. Mm-hmm. For example, I received an eviction notice from my community garden with some rather weak charges, like I forgot to pay half of my plot fee. And then I guess I let some weeds grow up in the garden and got kind of shabby. Does she have the right, or does someone have the right? The land is on the state of Vermont-owned property. Is there a due process that can be involved in this situation, or does she have the complete rule to say you're out?
That's an interesting question. I don't have the expertise in that area. And this is different from a landlord-tenant situation where folks actually lose a place to live. However, the Vermont Law School has an ag law clinic, and maybe Aaron has the number for those folks or someone there who can help you out. I know they've got some information on their website that might be useful to you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Aaron, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure. I was actually going to suggest the same thing, Mary. We have a food and agriculture clinic at the law school. But Jesse, what you might want to do is just call my clinic and we could get some more information from you and then try to connect you with the right person there. And I can give you and everyone our phone number at the clinic.
Okay, I'm ready. Yep.
That doesn't mean we can help everybody. our phone number is 802-831-1500.
All right, thank you, ma'am. I appreciate it. I will call that number.
All righty. Good luck, Jesse.
Thank you, sir.
I it had never occurred to me before you could have an eviction case involving a community garden. Danny, ever heard of such a thing?
No, but I'm not surprised. And Dave, we'll have to talk about the finder fee that you may ask for connecting these people.
No. I do this service for free. In fact, it's just amazing to me the connections that people make via the Dave Graham Show here. It's really phenomenal. On a whole, not just the law, but a whole lot of other topics and so on that folks call me after the show and say, who was that guy you were talking to? I want to reach out to him or whatever. So it's interesting.
I think a case like this is demonstrative of, you know, the needs that are out there. They're diverse. They come from areas that you might not expect. But, you know, this is serious. If Jesse relies upon a portion of that garden for his food supply, you know, that can have very serious implications to what, his family stability can be. That can have all kinds of ripple effects. And it seems like a very simple thing. It seems like something, I would never have thought about that. But it can be a much more impactful situation than you would realize. And those situations are lurking out there everywhere for just about everyone.
Yeah, there you go. One thing about November, I know a lot of organizations like to declare November as a special month in Vermont. And sometimes what's happening is that the legislature is going to be coming into session in January. People are trying to get their oars in the water about some additional funding. And Dan Richardson on the break, we were talking about that a little bit. Tell us what's going on there.
Sure. Well, the coalition... seeking this report to be publicized and the promotion of the Access to Justice Month is really about the report itself, which shows for the first time that we in the legal service, low-income legal service providers, make a huge benefit for the state in the form of the return from the investment in these type of legal services. The report shows that it's a 1-to-11 ratio. In 2017, this various funders, both the federal government, state of Vermont, and private sources, put $6 million into legal services. Out of that investment, the state of Vermont and Vermonters realized about $66.4 million in return. That's a 1-to-11 ratio. And that number breaks down into a series of components. One is about $32.7 million of that represents real income that was given to clients of legal services. Either they gained access to Social Security or Social Security disability. There were child support payments made that would otherwise not have been made. But that was money in people's pockets when they needed it. And we're talking about a very vulnerable segment of society where that money really does mean the difference between, you know, failure and success. And there's another $2.4 million in cost savings where, you know, people were in the eviction process, were, you know, given transition and did not have to go into homeless shelters or foreclosure services where, a person stayed in their home longer. As a result, you know, we avoided these costs that we would otherwise have to subsidize as taxpayers. And then there's a multiplier effect, which is all this money that goes into these people's hands go into the local economy. These aren't people that then take their money and invest it in stock or offshore Cayman's accounts. These are people that take their dollars and go and spend it at the local hardware store or the local grocery store or the local clothing store. And as a result, there's a multiplier effect of about 32.1 million dollars, and that number represents, you know, a benefit to Vermonters in the form of money staying within the community, allowing shopkeepers to spend it locally and to stay employed. And so, you know, this is a really impressive number, and it shows that I think in a lot of ways that the investment in low-income legal resources is a really good investment on a fiscal sense. And so what we're doing from here is to take this report and to show the legislature, to show the general public, and to show members of the bar that low-income legal services is a really sound investment in Vermont. This is what I often call domino funding, because we catch people with this kind of service at the beginning, before they fall into severe poverty, before they fall into homelessness, before they become either victims or perpetrators of crime, before they fall into addiction in some cases, or when they're on the road to recovery to not falling off said road. And that's really important because it's cheaper to do this than it is to do the other end, which is the criminal justice system, where it gets very expensive to deal with people after they've fallen off. And so, you know, eventually we're looking to make this push so that we can have additional funding, because I think this number, this high ratio, which is ahead of the curve in the country. Other states have done these studies, and they're much more modest rates of return. They're 5 to 1, 7 to 1. I think this shows that we have a lot of untapped ability to bring income into Vermont, into these people's pockets, with a little more funding.
Yeah, that that certainly is an argument I hear on behalf of a number of social programs. And obviously, you know, it's always a competition. As much as people don't like to really frame it in that sense, I don't mean it's a sporting event or anything, but it's a tough thing when the legislature has so many competing demands to juggle. And clearly, I think a lot of people are sympathetic to each other's requests and so on. So it is going to be a debate, I'm sure, in the legislature upcoming. We're going to get to a little bit more of that in the second half hour of our program this morning. For just a couple of minutes here, we're going to go to a break for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour, and then a couple of words from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Take the stress out of holiday shopping at the almost world-famous Warren Store. We have something for everyone on your list, from toys to beer, jewelry to wine, clothing to Yule logs. We have a wide selection of outerwear for men and women, all at 25% off from some of your favorite brands, such as Kohl, Royal Robbins, Prana, Save the Duck, and more. Holiday cards, wrap, candles, pottery, snow globes, always friendly, knowledgeable customer service, and free gift wrapping. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli, then head upstairs to shopping heaven. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Our conversation continues with Dan Richardson, former president of the Vermont Bar Association, an active Vermont Pelier attorney and regular legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Also in the studio with us this morning is Mary Ashcroft from the Vermont Bar Association. She is the legal access coordinator with that professional group of attorneys in Vermont. And Aaron Jacobson of the Vermont Law School's the South Royalton Legal Clinic is on the phone with us from South Royalton this morning. And I really appreciate the three of you staying with me into the second half hour of the program this morning. I think we are talking about a very important issue in Vermont, which is access to legal services. Aaron Jacobson, let me put this question to you. Relative to other states, how do you think Vermont is doing?
Well, I think Vermont is doing pretty well, actually. Some states have a larger justice gap. Mm-hmm. Certainly, some states might have a smaller one. But when we see efforts such as this one, where we're all putting our heads together to try to figure out what we can do better, then I think we will start being a leader in access to justice. On the coalition, we talk a lot about, you know, how we might explore some initiatives that could address the justice gap that maybe don't even involve lawyers. So it's many lawyers sitting at a table thinking about how we, you know, might put ourselves out of business, but that this, you know, in some places this is already happening. In a couple of states, they have programs such as in New York with court navigators, non-lawyers helping people through, for example, landlord-tenant hearings. Or in Washington State, where they have non-lawyers helping with family law cases. And certainly, this is already going on even in Vermont. Paralegals do a lot of crucial legal work. Accredited representatives can represent people in immigration proceedings. So we have to think creatively, and we have to think outside of the box. We're not expecting Vermont to just throw a bunch of money at lawyers. We don't think that's the solution. So, this month and moving forward, we're going to be thinking about some of these creative initiatives and maybe piloting some projects. And to some degree, that's where the legislature comes in, too.
Yeah, I gather that there's going to be an ask to the legislature for a boost in funding, I think you said, Dan, in the range of $1 million or $1.1 million?
That's correct. About $1.1 million in new funding in mm-hmm. addition to what these groups already receive. And that's reflective in large part because, you know, funding for legal aid and other organizations has been flat or cut in the past several years. And the numbers have gone up. So they're trying to do more with less. And as we all know, you can't do that. You can only do less with less.
Aaron was just talking about that putting heads together to think of ways to do more with less, including having some non-lawyers step up with a little more training or a little more ability to provide some of the legal advice that can not completely cover the gap, certainly, but expand the degree to which it's covered right now. Is that Mary Ashcroft? Do you think that's a workable idea?
Well, we see folks now, paralegals, appear a great deal of time in child support hearings in family court, and they are really the pillars of that court system. So paralegals are already being tapped, and they do great work for us.
Mm-hmm.
But let me get back to the lawyers for a minute, because a national study by the American Bar Association took a look at how many lawyers actually do pro bono work, and that's the for free legal services that we were talking about at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vermont, we're one of the leaders in the nation. 75% of our attorneys provide pro bono legal services every year, and we all aspire to a goal of about 50 hours a year. So that's a lot of legal services, but it still isn't enough to cover the justice gap that we're facing. And I do want to say something about the possible legislative funding. There are a couple of legal representations that are mandated by the legislature, by statutes that are already on the books and have been, but there's no funding that goes with them.
Hmm.
One is representation for folks, older folks sometimes young disabled people, when a family member petitions for guardianship of them. Those people, they're called respondents, proposed wards, they are required to have an attorney represent them. But there's no funding for it, and that's where pro bono attorneys come in and our low bono program. Similarly, when a person falls behind on child support and he or she is called into court on a possible contempt citation for not paying support, he or she faces jail time. And in that case, there should be an attorney representing him, but there isn't. So that's where, again, our program comes in, and that's where pro bono and low bono attorneys come in. But those are two justice gaps that we think really need to be covered with some funding.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, if the legislature is going to ask for it, I hear this complaint a lot from a wide range of folks in Vermont where they feel like they're affected by some kind of a state law. And it's an unfunded mandate, effectively, on their profession or their line of business or their municipality or whatever the case may be. And it sounds like this might be one. Now, if I'm a legislator who's trying to Again, keep the brakes on tax increases and make sure that I have funding for the full range of demands out there. I might be pushing back by saying, well, some of the other money we give you can be used in this area. What's your counter to that?
Well, let me take a pitch at it. That means taking money from some other legal service mm-hmm. organization and covering somebody else. Yeah. We see this a lot. We, for example, funding that was covering foreclosure defense stopped flowing to Vermont Legal Aid, who was doing a terrific job. So we at the Lo Bono program at the Bar Association started picking up the slack.
I see.
So if you cut off the funding to shift it in another direction, somebody has to cover the gap that it's created.
Yeah. Now tell me about pro bono and Lo Bono. I sort of had the impression that it was a requirement or something that to keep your law license, you were supposed to do a certain number of hours a year or something. Is that right?
It's a should rather than a shall.
I see.
We are supposed to, as attorneys, aspire to provide 50 hours of mm-hmm. Pro bono legal services each year. And many attorneys take that very seriously. And we give out awards every year to those who really go above and beyond. So it's not a requirement for licensing, but it is a strong encouragement.
Should it be should it be a should or shall it be a should, I guess?
Well, that has a lot of controversy. In large part, lawyers, like any people, any group of population, have different situations, and some attorneys can't do that. And what if an attorney's working part-time? That could be a huge burden on them. You know, I think it's one of these things. It would be a more salient conversation if there wasn't this large amount of cooperation. But lawyers at 75%, that's a large portion of the Vermont population of lawyers that are already engaged in this. And forcing that could alter that. You know, it's the idea of, you know, if you get someone to do something voluntarily, do you continue to encourage that? Or if you put a mandatory squeeze on them, are you going to get a lower rate of return? And we've seen that in fundraising because, you know, in addition to this, lawyers are very generous with their giving. And we're in the middle of a Access to Justice campaign right now that pays for the Poverty Law Fellow that's administered by the Vermont Bar Foundation. And lawyers every year fund that, you know, with their private dollars in addition to the other work that they do. As a profession, I think lawyers are really good about giving back, giving reduced rates. You know, there's a joke in the bar called involuntary pro bono, and that's when a client stops paying, but you don't stop representing them because their needs are so significant, or their needs are such that you just feel like you can't pull out, that they will lose something significant. And so I've done this, I know every lawyer out there has probably done this, where, you know, you have this client who stops paying and you can't really get out of the case, so you do it because it's the right thing to do. And I think that's the spirit in the bar. As it sits currently.
It's sort of like
Could I add to that?
Oh, sure. Go ahead, Erin.
I would also say that just kind of to echo this point about the spirit of the bar and pro bono, I call private attorneys all of the time for legal advice and for consultation. And, that you know, I can't pay them for their time, and nor can my clients. And I doubt that those attorneys are counting those hours on the phone with me as pro bono time. It's more just about being a collaborative member of the bar. And I think that is, you know, that's a really big part of the legal culture in Vermont.
Well, that is interesting. Dan, your remark about involuntary pro bono, I'm sure there's a little irony there, but I remember hearing, I was a longtime reporter for the Associated Press, and I remember hearing about some newspapers accidentally turning to nonprofit status. And so that's another way to look at these kinds of things, I guess. But anyway, Mary Ashcroft, it is an interesting thing to me, this idea that that if you impose a requirement on somebody, it all of a sudden becomes a lot less fun and a lot less You don't get that sort of internal generosity reward that you can get from doing good work based on the goodness of your heart. I understand, and I'm hearing from the three of you really that there's a lot to be lost there also.
Yeah, I've mentioned my low bono programs, and to be very frank about it, we pay lawyers $60 an hour between 3 hours and 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And many of the cases that I assign go much longer than 3 hours or 10 hours, and the lawyers stick with it. As Dan said, you don't leave a client when the funding runs out. You keep going. But those attorneys know that they're going to keep going, and they take the case knowing that. So they're very generous spirit out there.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, in the case of the individual parts of this puzzle here, we talk about representing folks who are going through foreclosure, representing folks who are going through divorce, representing folks who are going through other family matters, etc. What are the types of cases that are the most needful right now?
Family law. Family law. We consider it the elephant in the room. There are so many folks, and I read off the statistics earlier, people attempting to represent themselves in family division cases. One of the...
You mean divorce cases, right?
Divorce, yeah. Parentage, attempts to get child support once the order is issued, but the payments stop. And post-judgment things, I see a lot because we are partners in the Victims of Crime Project here in Vermont. I see a lot of requests for attorneys to participate in family cases where a parent has suffered abuse, domestic violence, and is trying to protect the children. And he or she will come in and ask for... A change of custody or a change in the conditions of visitation. And that's where we need a lot of attorneys helping out. And family court is tough. It takes a lot of emotion, and it often is a case that goes on and on. But I would say family. Landlord-tenant cases, we have a lot of those, and we tend to get the ones that we represent low-income landlords as well. And these would be people, I was just looking at a case where a mom wanted to help her son out, so she let her son and his girlfriend move in. The girlfriend became abusive. They weren't paying rent, and mom just wanted them out to protect herself. So we found a low bono attorney to help them out.
Wow. You know, that is another thing that folks need to think about here, which is that there are so many stereotypes about how things are going to unfold in these individual cases. And it turns out that there are many, many variables here. You know, I think the classic stereotypical case, I might have expected to hear that the boyfriend became abusive because men commit the lion's share of domestic abuse. And so here the girlfriend becomes abusive, and that's not to diminish anything about domestic abuse committed by men or whatever, but it just tells you that these cases come in just an infinite variety of colors.
Very true. We also have done landlord-tenant cases involving mobile homes in mobile home parks. We had a case in the southern part of the state where a woman had been in a mobile home park with her mobile home for about 2 decades. A neighbor moved in next door, became abusive toward her, and the mobile home park owner decided to fix the problem by evicting both of them, which wasn't really fair to her. We found an attorney to help her out, and she was able to stay with her mobile home in the park where she'd been for so long.
Yeah, it must actually be quite rewarding when you feel like you can do these kinds of cases and come to a good outcome. That must be the win, right?
Oh, it's great. One of my favorite phone calls to make is to call up one of these folks who have requested one of our attorneys and to tell them, I have an attorney for you, and to give them the information. And I also send out questionnaires at the end and to ask clients, how did we do? How did the lawyer do? Mm-hmm. And the responses are heartwarming. They're so very grateful.
Mary Ashcroft, the Vermont Bar Association, what would you step up first? Would it be the family law area if you got this increased funding from the legislature?
One of the ideas we have is just that, to provide statewide legal clinics where attorneys can meet, volunteer attorneys, and sometimes low bono attorneys or legal aid attorneys. They can meet with people who are in the family court process and help them fill out the forms, help them prepare for a hearing, help them know how to put exhibits into evidence. So that would be an enormous benefit, I think, and it would provide direct service to a client just before they headed to court and needed to get those forms done correctly. Our idea is to do it maybe as much as an hour-long consultation between lawyer and client, and that's just one example. That's how we would tackle that problem.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, let me zero in on this idea of the proper way to prepare an exhibit for admission to a court. And if you're a pro bono client, I mean, you're a pro se client, meaning you're representing yourself, that's got to be pretty intimidating.
I think so. I know that, you know, sometimes folks who are representing themselves come in with letters, and they get a friend to write up an affidavit, and they think that those are automatically going to be allowed by the court. Sometimes they hold up their cell phone and they want to show a text message that they have received, and they don't understand it has to be maybe reduced to writing, and the whole string of the conversation has to be part of the exhibit, not just the one screenshot they have.
I see. So there really is a fair amount to be thinking about as you get ready to, and there's a good chance that if you don't do it properly, the court will just reject it out of hand, right?
Right. And certainly if there's a lawyer on the other side, the lawyer is going to be objecting.
Objecting to your, and then the judge has a has an obligation to follow the normal rules of evidence and the law, and perhaps you're presenting a very, very sympathetic case that deep in her heart of hearts or his heart of hearts, the judge might really be interested in figuring out a way to rule in your favor. But gee whiz, if you don't do the paperwork right, you lose. That's got to be a heartbreaking thing at times.
It is. Before we leave, can I mention our resources again, the 800 number?
Yes, that's actually a great idea because okay. We are down to the last minute and 30 seconds here, it looks like.
Okay, so intake for a lot of legal services programs, call the 800 number, 1-800-889-2047, or go online to VT, that's Vermont, VT, lawhelp.org, and we'll see if we can get some legal help to you.
And Aaron Jacobson at the Vermont Law School, you had a phone number as well. I want you to share that one more time.
Sure. Our phone number at the clinic is 802-831-1500, and we primarily work with veterans and immigrants. Also, we help domestic violence survivors and children in Orange and Windsor counties. But like I said before, we're happy to help connect people with the exact kind of legal assistance they might need if we're not the ones who can provide that.
Bottom line here, folks, is if you are out there with a potential legal problem and you are feeling like you could never afford a lawyer, go ahead and make the call to these numbers here. They may very well have some help for you. So I appreciate my three guests coming in, Mary Ashcroft of the Vermont Bar Association, Aaron Jacobson from the South Royalton Law Clinic at Vermont Law School, and Dan Richardson. Thank the three of you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
And we're going to be back with more of the Dave Graham Show after we break for some CBS news at the top of the hour. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back, folks.
We hear a lot about shopping local, and here in the Mad River Valley, we put our money where our mouths are. Make your holiday shopping a joyful adventure far from the press and stress of the big box stores. Come to the Mad River Valley and experience the joys and charms of a quintessential New England holiday. Stores, bars, and restaurants to fill a day trip, or take a few ski runs before heading into Warren or Waitsfield for lunch or a snack while checking off the items on your list. At the Warren store, you'll find something for everyone. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, where we're fun, funky, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
In the second hour of the Dave Graham Show, we are going to be doing one of our Seeds to Society segments. This is something we've been doing every Thursday for a couple of months now, where we collaborate with the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont, and they are able to line us up with a whole lot of interesting and informative topics, everything from what's going on with the U.S. Census to discussions about the bringing in sheep to keep your winery rows nicely mowed and trimmed, the grass nicely trimmed. Fascinating stuff that these folks have been bringing to us from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Two people from there are going to be joining me in the starting at about 10:15 this morning to talk about salmonella and backyard chickens. A lot of folks like the idea of raising their own chickens. I will say that my family and I have tried this a couple of times ourselves and found it to be an interesting experience. I built a little chicken coop and we fed them lots of food, and then I added up the cost of the lumber for the chicken coop and the cost of the food and et cetera, et cetera, and discovered we were paying about $150 a pound for chicken. But that's just us. Maybe other people have a little bit better luck with this, and I'll be interested to hear. I hope that our listeners will be able to join in to the conversation. We're going to be joined also by Dr. Andrea Etter. She's an associate professor in the University of Vermont Department of Nutrition and Food Science, and we also have joining us a student, Melissa. Her last name is spelled D-E-C-I-C-C-O. Dana, how do you pronounce D-E-C-I-C-C-O?
Tell you the truth, I never have.
Okay, well,
it'll be a first time. For something to the effect of DeChicco.
Or DeSicho, or we'll get it from her when we get her on the phone. So that'll be the first, maybe the first thing we'll learn on that segment of the Dave Graham Show, which starts in a little under 10 minutes here on WDEV FM and AM. So the fact that we have about 10 minutes here means that if any listeners out there would like to call us and talk to us about the latest news here in Vermont or the latest news nationally or anything else that is on your mind, we have a little notch of time here between now and about 10:15 when we could take a couple calls at 244-1777. 1-877-291-8255. I'm actually really curious to know if any listeners have had some experience of trying to get some legal assistance here in Vermont. Have you run into roadblocks? We had a whole hour of a discussion in the just completed a few minutes ago here, folks from the Vermont Bar Association, Vermont Law School, and talking about access to justice. It's Access to Justice Month in Vermont. You probably didn't know that, but it was declared by the state Supreme Court, and the object here is to make sure that as many people as possible who need representation in civil legal cases are able to get it. And apparently there is quite a large justice gap where that doesn't happen. People end up representing themselves in court. And what's the old saying? I think there's something about only a fool has him or herself for a lawyer, I think, or something like that. There's a lot to it. You know, you have to file the motion with the court in exactly the right format, or it can easily be rejected by the judge, even if the judge would rather give you a favorable ruling. The other side has a lawyer, typically. They're going to object, and then the judge is forced to follow the rules of evidence and so on. And it's a tough business. It's a takes a lot of training and knowledge. That's why lawyers, at least by reputation anyway, cost a lot of money. These folks are trying to help people who don't have a lot of money get some legal representation. I really enjoyed meeting with Mary Ashcroft of the Vermont Bar Association, Aaron Jacobson, who's with the South Royalton Legal Clinic at the Vermont Law School. And these folks are doing good work in trying to spread out the availability of legal services to as many people as possible. And of course, Dan Richardson was my guest in the first hour as well, and he's very kindly shared a lot of his knowledge and expertise, insights about the law with the Dave Graham Show. I think he feels like that's a good public service to fill people in somewhat on how the law works in our society, and it's important stuff.
And certainly Dan has been a big help to me, and I really appreciate his willingness to provide us with some guidance from time to time and take calls from the listeners, et cetera. It's a good, really good service he's doing there. So, I'm curious to know if any listeners out there have any stories they'd like to share about how did that go when you called one of these clinics that or in services that are designed to help out people with legal problems who maybe don't have enough money to pay the sort of standard thing you hear about. It's just $250 an hour or more for legal services if you have the money to spend. And but they're also available some help for a lot less than that or even for free for people who need that help. Of course, this is all we're talking about, the civil side, the place where landlord-tenant disputes get resolved, where family law happens, the divorces and parental separations and terminations of parental rights and all of that kind of stuff, which could be very, very difficult. On the criminal side, in most serious criminal cases, the state will provide a low-income person with legal representation that's called for in the Constitution. And that is something that, you know, they can't deprive you of your liberty without some kind of due process and at least a stab at fairness. And so that requires that sometimes that the state provides you with a public defender if you're in the criminal side of the courthouse. And that's a somewhat different thing than what we were talking about today. Meanwhile, of course, the news percolates along. There's always lots of stuff going on related to the impeachment inquiry in Washington and to other doings of our esteemed president, Donald J. Trump. There is some public hearings going to be getting underway in the House of Representatives next week, I believe it's. And, of course, the Republicans who earlier on were clamoring for a public process are still unhappy with what's coming in terms of the public hearings that the Democrats are offering up here. The impeachment inquiry rolls along here. President Trump was at a rally last night and was railing against the Democrats, the impeachment inquiry. And the Hill actually has a very interesting story about the president's appearance. Starts out by saying President Trump spent the outset of a campaign rally Wednesday evening railing against House Democrats, accusing them of pursuing a deranged, delusional, destructive, and hyperpartisan impeachment witch hunt. That is quite a pile of words there, folks. It's a hoax. It's a scam, Trump said, told a cheering crowd at the Monroe Civic Center in Louisiana. Quote, I had a perfect phone call, a totally perfect phone call. He added, referring to his July 25th phone conversation with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump also continued his attacks on the credibility of the anonymous whistleblower who raised alarm about the call, accusing the individual of making, quote, a horrible statement, unquote, about the call and claiming without evidence that the person had, quote, disappeared, unquote, after the White House released a transcript of it. Now, there's an interesting aspect of this whole discussion about the whistleblower, which is that the whistleblower has had his or her story confirmed by several other witnesses now about this phone call. So that's another thing you have to reflect on. Is the president continues to attack the whistleblower, a lot of folks have backed up that story. And so we'll have to see what unfolds on that in the coming days. Thursday's the second hour of the program I've been devoting to something we call our Seeds to Society segment. It is made in collaboration with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. That organization, that section of the University of Vermont has stepped up with a list of topics that are really worth talking about here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. A whole range of subjects, and this week we are going to be speaking with a couple of experts, one actually professor and one student, on the topic of salmonella and the threat from that pathogen posed to folks who want to raise some backyard chickens. And joining me to discuss all this would be Dr. Andrea Etter. She's an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Science at the University of Vermont. And we also have a senior microbiology student by the name of Melissa. And Melissa, help me with the pronunciation of your last name.
It's DeSico.
DeSico, okay. Excellent. And thank you both for joining me this morning. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having us. Just a quick note, you gave me a promotion. I'm actually an assistant professor.
Oh, okay. I have the notes I got from up there were says associate professor, but I'm happy to give you whichever title is the most appropriate here. So it's assistant professor, is it?
Correct. I've only actually been at UVM for about a year.
Got it. Okay. And so the subject for today actually is one interesting to me because my family and I tried, my son in particular sort of took the lead on this project, but we were raising backyard chickens for a couple of years. So we have our own experience in this area. And I wanted to ask, first off, if either of you knows how many Vermont households raise backyard chickens?
You know, I do not have a number on that. I've been asked that a lot, but I don't think there's any sort of registry.
Yep.
There are quite a few. We got 28 flocks within 2 hours of Burlington, and that's obviously not everyone who has chickens. So I would think it is really, really common. Melissa, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I also think it's pretty common because there was also some people that we got in the survey that we didn't sample because they might have had more than 30 chickens.
Right.
Melissa DeSico, are you from Vermont yourself?
No, I'm from Pennsylvania.
Okay. And have you had experience growing backyard chickens in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I have 7 chickens back home right now.
Wow, okay. And I gather you're studying there in Burlington. You must have family back home who are doing the daily feeding and et cetera.
Yes, they do. Very begrudgingly, but they do.
Boy, how about that Melissa? She sets us up in backyard chickens and then takes off for college. What's up with that? Well, it's a chore. I mean, that's why they call them chores on the farm or around the house, actually, is that there are times when you feel like, it's kind of cold. I don't really feel like going out to the chicken coop and feeding these beasts, but you got to do it. So that's just part of the love, I guess, or something like that. Dr. Andrea Etter, tell us a little bit about the problem here. The problem statement came to me as there is an issue with salmonella and backyard chickens. Why should people be worried about this?
So this year, the CDC collected data that indicated about 1,000 cases of foodborne illness of salmonella, people getting salmonella from backyard chicken exposure.
Mm-hmm.
In Vermont, over the last 4 years, the data indicate that about 17 to 19 people a year get salmonella, probably from exposure to backyard chickens. There's a lot of other cases of salmonella, but these are cases where people had backyard chickens, so they're the prime suspect.
And what are some of the steps that people want to think about or to avoid salmonella with their backyard chickens?
Right. So one of the points of this project was actually collecting data on what people do and how much they know. So we had a survey, and then we would go and we would actually take a fecal sample, probably best understood as a butt swab, of the backyard chickens to see if they had salmonella. So some of the things that people might want to think about are how they view the chicken. So some people really think of chickens as pets, and they're not. They're livestock.
Yeah.
And kids especially can be very cuddly with chickens. And chickens, the thing with chickens is they can have salmonella as adults and not have a sign of it. So your perfectly healthy-looking hen with great fluffy, glossy feathers, and who just seems so lively and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, could be carrying salmonella.
Right. And that's something, so you tell your children, basically, stand back, you can watch the chickens, they'll cluck around and pluck around on the ground and eat their food and do their various little activities and so on and so forth, but it's probably better just not to pick them up, right?
Correct. I know it's hard for kids mm-hmm. chickens are fun.
Yep.
I grew up with chickens, too. A lot of pictures of me cuddling chickens as a kid.
Did you ever catch salmonella? I mean, you come down with an illness related to it?
I don't know. I don't have any recollection of anything that would have really matched that, but we had a lot of other animals, and I have a number of siblings, so knowing the difference between the stomach flu and salmonella is tricky.
Yeah, well, actually, that raises an interesting point right there, which is that let's talk for a moment about the symptoms of salmonella, about the course of the disease, about any cures or efforts to treat it.
So it's usually a really simple disease. It might last a couple of days, maybe a week at tops. Usually, you're going to experience cramps, nausea, diarrhea, maybe vomiting, maybe if you're really unlucky, both diarrhea and vomiting, or as we like to call it, bidirectional fluid loss. So it's going to feel like a nasty case of stomach or gastrointestinal flu.
Yeah.
But most of the time it's going to resolve quickly enough that people won't go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to get diagnosed. Usually the person's body will clear it on its own. For someone who is in one of the more at-risk categories, so kids under the age of 6, adults over the age of 65, people with an immunocompromising condition, such as could be anything from diabetes, do they had an organ transplant, do they have cancer, do they have HIV,
mm-hmm.
you name it, and pregnant women are more at risk for complications such as septicemia, a blood infection, or just a really severe bout of the disease. So people usually end up in the hospital because they get dehydrated, not because they have septicemia.
Let me ask you about contagion, because I'll put it this way: if one child goes out and cuddles with a chicken and develops symptoms of salmonella, is he or she a threat to his or her siblings?
I'm going to let Melissa answer this because she's also got a lot of knowledge and experience in this.
Okay, Melissa.
Yeah. So it can be transmitted to other people. And because if they have, like, they don't wash their hands and they shake someone's hand, it can obviously go that way.
But yeah, it's going to be mostly a fecal oral route. It's in your intestines. It has to somehow get onto a surface where it's then going to make its way into your mouth. So yeah. Somebody using improper hygiene and then cooking is a good example. But really, treating it like you would the stomach flu and just bleaching everything is going to take care of it.
I see. Okay. So it is fairly, it's not like norovirus. I mean, my experience with norovirus is that when one member of a family gets that, the rest of the family is pretty sure to follow.
Right. But though that can also be controlled with bleaching everything like mad.
Okay. Good to know, because that's a nasty deal. We've had that in our household once or twice over the years, and that's no fun. I mean, that's like the classic gastrointestinal flu, and you're throwing up, and you're having all sorts of stomach distress, and then your spouse or your child is next in line, and you know, yikes. Anyway,
right? No, it doesn't have to be sequential, and for salmonella, it certainly isn't necessarily. It's mostly going to be foodborne.
Okay, so are most of the cases of salmonella that result from having backyard chickens, are most of them in this kind of, as you call it, a cuddling situation, or is there some risk to the folks who are going to be involved at the late stages of the process, as in actually processing the chickens and slaughtering them and getting them ready for cooking?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you get manure on your hands and you don't wash your hands, it's a risk. Mostly we are looking at people who are raising chickens for eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we'd start with seeing how many chickens had salmonella and then look at eggs. But we actually didn't find any salmonella, which is really good for backyard owners, but does not mean there is not salmonella out there.
Huh.
We're only testing 28 flocks, 233 chickens, you know.
Yep.
It's a limited study.
and you didn't find any salmonella, and of these 28 flocks, were any of them for slaughter, or were they all for egg birds?
They were all egg birds.
Okay. So are there different risk profiles in connection with folks who are raising meat birds versus egg birds?
That is a really good question. Salmonella, people frequently contract salmonella from meat that is contaminated with salmonella due to the fact that the chicken it came from.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the more common ways people get sick. And certainly people who are slaughtering chickens in their backyard are not necessarily observing best practices in terms of hygiene for slaughter.
Yeah, that is something that is you've got to be careful, and there are techniques that one would, I hope, study before deciding to really to raise either meat birds or egg birds. But I know our experience in my household, we raised some meat birds.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite an involved and intense process, of course, when you are getting ready to and going through the various steps of slaughtering the chickens and plucking them and getting them ready for the freezer, it involves multiple family members or family and friends usually, and there are a lot of stages to it, and so I could imagine there would be potential for folks who to make mistakes at the various stages.
Right. I mean, people don't usually slaughter their chickens wearing gloves, nitrile gloves or rubber gloves.
Yep.
A lot of people still use wooden cutting boards, which is a terrible idea when you're dealing with raw meat. You cannot sanitize them effectively.
What kind of cutting boards?
Wood cutting boards.
Yeah, that's a no-no.
Yeah.
Should be a good plastic surface, right?
Well, you should really have a cutting board that's dedicated to dealing with raw meat. And
yep.
And you should sanitize it after use.
Absolutely. Yeah. And bleach is going to be effective there, right?
Yeah, but you want to get off all the fat and any other bits of meat and feathers and all that first, because bleach doesn't work well if there's any sort of contaminating material on the surface.
Yeah, that's a good point, and it's something that do it carefully and thoroughly, because what's the best? If you have a plastic cutting board, what sort of a scrubbing tool should you use to make sure it's got all the particles removed?
I would just use soap and water.
Mm-hmm.
And, because anything you scrub it with is potentially contaminated now, too.
Yeah, that's true. And so all of this stuff is definitely worth really thinking about it and focusing on it. And my son, who kind of got the family into this idea for a while, actually had some training as a meat cutter and had the serve safe certificate, which we could talk a little bit about after our bottom of the hour break. There are a lot of considerations when you're getting ready to deal with this kind of stuff, and it's I think it's important information. I'm also hoping to open the phone line some in the last half hour of the program this morning, and get listeners to call in and talk about maybe some of their experiences in raising chickens, either for eggs or for meat, and find out what you saw and learned about the process as you went through it.
Right.
We are going to go to a bottom of the hour break, though, here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We've got some CBS News, just a news minute coming up, and a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more of the folks from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences for the remainder of our weekly Seeds to Society segment. Folks, stay with us.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smart Wool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Backyard flocks of chicken are increasingly common in Vermont and across the United States, and along with that, the number of outbreaks associated with live poultry also has increased, with 70 outbreaks of salmonellosis from backyard chickens occurring since 2000. However, few studies have assessed the prevalence of S. enterica in backyard flocks. A study of Maryland backyard flocks found no salmonella in 39 flocks. Another study in the greater Boston urban area found salmonella in just 2% of flocks tested. Neither of these studies investigated differences in rural and urban flock or whether the prevalence of salmonella is different in heritage versus commercial breeds. Between June and October, my two guests this morning, Professor Etter and student Melissa DeSico, enrolled 233 chickens in 28 farms across Vermont. They were a mixture of rural and urban chickens, with housing ranging from free range to entirely fenced in yards. They found that Vermonters raise chickens for a variety of reasons, including superior nutrition from homegrown eggs, superior taste. Boy, the homegrown eggs are really, they really are something different from your typical supermarket eggs, that is for sure. And would you say when talking to people, that's the key reason, Professor Etter, on why folks are going this route?
It's the perceived superior nutrition and the perceived superior taste for the top two.
And you say perceived. I guess it's difficult to measure taste, but what about nutrition? I mean, people can measure that in the lab, right?
Yeah, you can. There's slight differences between commercial and homegrown eggs, but there's no evidence that there's a really strong benefit from homegrown versus commercial eggs.
And you said that in this study in which you enrolled, and that strikes me as a kind of a funny verb there. It sounds like somebody's going to college or whatever. But 233 chickens in 28 different flocks across Vermont, and you found no salmonella in your study.
Correct.
Similar to the one in Maryland that looked at 39 flocks.
Yeah.
Wow. And so this stuff's kind of elusive, but we know it's out there.
Correct.
And so. That's why people need to really be careful here. Do you feel like when you got these results and said, "Wow, no salmonella," that gives you confidence that Vermont chicken keepers are doing a good job?
Yeah, I think overall, I was surprised that we didn't find any salmonella.
Mm-hmm.
I would have expected to find at least one chicken with salmonella. And it would have been nice in terms of establishing an actual percentage. So, I mean, really all we can say is that less than 5.5% of chickens have salmonella based on these results, and less than 3% of flocks were seen have salmonella. But we don't know what the actual percentage is because we didn't find. We just know it's less than these certain benchmarks.
But meanwhile, the figures seem to indicate if you look at the human end of this equation, 19 Vermonters became ill from salmonella acquired from backyard chickens in this year, in 2019, matching the 2016-28 average for Vermont. Consequently, the Dr. Andrea Etter, you folks are. I mean, is there some luck involved here? Did you just?
Yeah.
Sort of not pick the right egg carton, so to speak.
Well, I mean, obviously there's a little bit of luck. Some of it is geography as well, possibly. So we were mostly getting flocks around Burlington and Charlotte,
mm-hmm.
Within like a half hour radius of Burlington, because that's where we could advertise most effectively.
And when you went out to visit folks and look at their flocks, were you saying? Basically good sanitary practices out there that would tell you that there's a reason we're not finding any salmonella?
I'll let Melissa chime in here.
Yeah, Melissa, what did you find out there?
It really depends because the farms, the coops are so different between farm to farm.
Mm-hmm.
So the sanitation practices for that particular coop might be a little bit different, a little bit more high maintenance than some of the other coop designs. But overall, most of them were pretty solid with sanitation.
Right. I mean, we saw some really beautiful coops, and we saw some that were not quite as beautiful and not quite as clean. Definitely, we didn't ask people how often they cleaned their coops, but that would have been an interesting thing to ask.
How often, let's say you have a dozen egg birds, how often should you clean your coop?
Well, that is a good question. I would think once a year minimum, but mm-hmm. definitely anytime you bring in new birds, you want to have bringing them into a clean coop.
Yeah. Anytime you bring in new birds, you want to introduce them to a clean coop. Is that what you said?
Yeah, because okay. You don't really want, well, first of all, you want to quarantine them for a few weeks to make sure they're not sick.
Yep.
And that they aren't passing things between each other. And second, you want to avoid passing anything your birds might have onto these new guys, especially if you're starting completely over. Say you have a bunch of old birds and you decide it's time to put them down and get a new flock. You want to make sure you're starting fresh with as little cross-contamination between the two flocks as possible.
I see. Okay, so that takes some care and some actually separate housing, it sounds like, for the new chicks on the block, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, it's ideal to keep them separate for a bit. Also, if you're bringing in chicks to a flock of full-grown birds, you might want to wait until they're a little older, make sure that adults don't, you know, pick on them.
Yeah, that is certainly an issue with chickens. And that, as well as we haven't even touched on the other big issue that we ran into once or twice, and others, friends and neighbors who've had chickens, which is wildlife getting in there. That's another threat that people need to be concerned with. You don't want to hear any weasels or skunks in the middle of the night in your chicken coop.
Yeah, we had a few times where we went to the farm, and they told us they had like 8 birds, and by the time we got there, they had 4 because there was a fox or a bobcat or a weasel or a fisher cat.
Yeah.
Or a hawk.
And some animals, is it minks, I think, will actually kill the entire flock and then think they're going to come back later or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
Yep. And so in your looking at salmonella in general in backyard chickens, do you think that Vermont is about where we are nationally, or are we doing a little better than the national average, including in trying to avoid salmonella, or how do we stack up against other parts of the country?
That is a good question. In general, salmonella likes the warm climate. So, but again, what you have to think about is how common are backyard flocks in general. So yeah, there's a CDC map of all the places that have had illnesses from backyard chickens this past year. And I think we're up to 49 out of 50 states, if not every single state, this year has had illnesses from backyard chickens. And there's a lot of variation, but states vary a lot in size. Vermont is a small state, and backyard chickens are really common here. They're not going to necessarily be equally common in all the states. That would be fascinating data to get, but it would be really, really complicated to make sure you were actually doing correct comparisons.
Yeah, that would be a tough thing to, as you say, make sure you're doing an apples to apples and not apples to oranges comparison between the different parts of the country when it comes to how folks are doing in avoiding salmonella contamination in there. And by the way, let's back up a bit and ask a little bit about salmonella itself. Is it a virus or a bacterium, or what is it?
It's a bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually fairly closely related to E. coli.
Okay.
Like the E. coli that live in your gut. It's not like the E. coli you can get from eating raw beef.
Yeah. Is it short-lived, long-lived? I mean, will it survive for quite a while on the surface of a cutting board, for instance?
There have been some studies. It depends on the surface. Some salmonella survive longer than others. It can survive for days to maybe weeks, depending. But the bigger threat is bacteria can form like a colony covered in essentially slime.
Mm-hmm.
In the right circumstances, it's called a biofilm, and that is really, really difficult to get rid of. Industry, basically, if you get a biofilm in a piece of equipment, you're going to take that piece of equipment and get rid of it because
out of service,
you can't get rid of the biofilm.
Yep.
So for consumers, the risk is you're growing biofilms in your drain, you're growing biofilms on your cutting board potentially, especially if you're not cleaning it off right away. You let it sit for a while.
Let me ask you this. Are people, if people want to have, you know, sort of the fresh eggs, they like the stiffer, yellower yolks, and they like the flavor, and they think that they are superior in nutrition or taste or whatever, are people smarter to try to do this in their own backyards, or are they better off going to a local, you know, organic farmer who has a little more of a specialty in this field?
That's a good question. So, again, without having firm data on salmonella, I mm-hmm. don't actually know the answer to that. It's something I would really love to answer.
Yeah, I actually think that might be a key question for for our listeners and just general consumers out there who are thinking about, you know, they like eggs and they like the I've had the fresh eggs versus the supermarket eggs, and fresh eggs are just, you know, they make a great omelet. They stand up really well, and they're fantastic compared to, and supermarket eggs, I don't mean to cut them down because I mean they're okay. I eat them on a pretty routine basis, but it's a different thing. And I you know, sort of like I don't know, any number of other things where Vermonters love their fresh local produce and stuff. It's a great thing. But the question then becomes, and another issue actually is the economics, I think about, because chicken feed is not cheap. When you go over to your local Agway or Tractor Supply or whatever to buy a bag of chicken feed, that's a budget item.
It can be. A lot of people we saw would feed their chickens a mixture of things. It was really common to give them garden scraps.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way you can cut down your food cost or have them be more free range.
Yep.
I mean, you can give them the Cadillac of chicken food or whatever, but you don't have to. They're going to be pretty content scratching for stuff in the dirt.
And then, of course, if you really want to raise, you know, quality meat, if you're doing meat birds, you got to care about what's in the chicken feed too. And you know, that's a key consideration as well. So.
But that's kind of a little bit of a different thing than backyard chicken eggs, I think.
Yep.
Raising chickens for eggs is a lot more straightforward.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, with eggs, well, actually, let me ask about that. Do eggs vary according to what the chickens are eating very much?
I'm sure there's an effect. But, I mean, that's why people like free-range eggs from the grocery store rather than ones from commercially raised chickens.
Yeah.
There are subtle differences.
Interesting stuff. I think a lot of Vermonters, I bet you a lot of Vermonters are listening carefully to you folks, because this is something that people either are doing or they're contemplating doing it or have some experience doing. So I wanted to ask you a couple of other questions. Melissa, you were, it sounds like out there face to face or nose to beak or whatever with the with the flocks. And was the absence of the salmonella your most surprising finding?
I'd say the absence of the salmonella was the most surprising finding, but we also found a lot of interesting data about knowledge and how people use, like, their biosecurity practices with their chickens, which I thought was really fascinating.
That's it. And did you find the level of knowledge fairly high?
We found that there was a lot of people who who would either use home remedies or put down the bird if they were sick, which was interesting. And there was some other practices like washing and not refrigerating the eggs, or washing and refrigerating the eggs, or not doing both.
I remember Dr. Etter, you were mentioning that rubber gloves are key when handling chickens when you're gathering eggs also?
You know, as long as you're washing your hands, that's the biggest thing. I don't think anyone needs to go out and feel like they have to buy a pack of rubber gloves. If you're cleaning the chicken coop, gloves and a mask might be a good idea, and certainly wash your clothes. We did see a lot of people change their shoes after being out in the chicken coop. That's also a good thing. I mean, I grew up in a rural area, and we definitely had shoes that you wore out in the mud.
Yeah.
And shoes that you wore inside.
You don't want to be tracking that mud into the house or anything else from the barn, shall we say. You
don't want to be tracking in the chicken poop.
That is true, yes. What about future efforts in this project here? What are your next steps?
I will actually let Melissa talk about this, because she's going to be continuing with me in the spring as a graduate student.
Oh, okay.
And continuing to work on this project.
All right. Melissa, tell us what's next in this project.
So the next step for us is looking at baby chicks specifically. Is the CDC right? The CDC said that there's more likely to be salmonella in the baby chicks and then have them clear it when they get older. So we want to look at the baby chicks to see if that's true and to confirm that.
So we're going to go out and we're going to look at baby chicks in the spring.
That is that's worthwhile. I would think, just because obviously that's a population of chicks that are chickens that I guess didn't get much of a look see this time, right?
Yeah, we only had a few small chicks, mostly ones that people had their hens sit on their eggs and raise chicks. And the other thing with baby chicks, of course, is that they're so cute that they're like a little biohazard ball of risk for kids, especially. They're small and they're fluffy and they're cute. And like, I know that baby chicks are not 100% safe. And I see a baby chick and I want to pick it up and cuddle it. And I'm a scientist, so I'm.
They are cute, aren't they?
Yeah. They are adorable. I have a friend who has some baby chicks, and I just love going over and watching them.
Yep. And I'm sure many, many families have pictures of their little baby humans, not complete infants, not complete babies, but 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, cuddling with chicks. And it's always it's a joyful moment that you're capturing there. But it can lead to less joyful moments. Let's put it that way.
Very true.
I wanted to circle back to one thing I don't think we covered adequately, which was the disparity between the absence of salmonella in the study group, the sample group, I guess it was that you looked at, and these 233 chickens in 28 farms or 28 flocks, I guess, around the area, and there are 19 cases this year though of people said to have contracted salmonella from backyard chickens. So clearly, it's sort of like somebody saying, well, you didn't catch any, but there are some fish in this pond.
Correct. Yeah. So again, we didn't cover all of Vermont.
Yep.
And so that's one thing. The method we used, cecal swabs, it can be hard to get a strong enough sample to catch a very faint signal.
I see. Yeah, sure.
The reason we chose that particular method is if you just collect poop samples from the yard, you don't know what chickens are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't assume the entire flock has salmonella just because one or two birds do. They might or they might not. We wanted to get more precise data. But of course, then we potentially missed some birds that had really low levels of salmonella.
Now, when you find a bird with salmonella in your backyard flock, are you required to slaughter it, or what's the protocol there?
I would say the protocol is you go and you call your vet.
You call your vet?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the chances are you can give your chickens some fairly straightforward, simple antibiotics and clear the salmonella.
I see. Okay. So it's not like rabies or something.
Oh,
not,
no.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, that would be a different... different situation completely, but that is a so we just got a couple of minutes to go here, and I wanted to ask the two of you, maybe each of you could take a stab at this, but what are the key takeaways from this session of the Dave Graham Show you would like listeners to get? Let's start with Melissa.
Just because we didn't find salmonella, this is a major takeaway. That we didn't find salmonella doesn't mean that there isn't salmonella still out there, and you should still practice all the same biosecurity practices that you've been doing, or update your biosecurity practices, because just because a bird looks healthy doesn't mean it isn't carrying salmonella.
Yeah, that is a that's a good point, that that it is a hidden thing. I mean, it's not an obvious thing, certainly, when if a bird is carrying salmonella, you've got to be a little more wary than that. Let me go to Dr. Etter. What would you say you'd like our listeners to have learned from this 45 minutes of radio just now?
Right. So I think backyard chicken owners can feel good that they don't need to be too paranoid about their backyard chickens. But as Melissa said, you still should be cautious. One of the more interesting things we saw is that people had a lot more confidence in the safety of their backyard chickens' eggs than in backyard chicken eggs in general. And a lot of people thought they were safer than store eggs. And the data they neither support nor refute that claim, but you should not assume that your backyard chickens are safer than anyone else's just because they're yours. Just because you know your chickens does not mean your chickens could not get you sick. You don't have an agreement with the salmonella.
Well, that's a good thought to leave with. I think folks need to be wary on all ends of this thing to some extent, and make sure that you're practicing good sanitation at every stage of caring for your backyard chickens, and or being aware of the possibility of developing salmonella from store-bought eggs or store-bought chickens. So that's always a possibility as well. There you go. Well, that is about it for this segment of the Seeds to Society program on the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Andrea Etter and Melissa DeSico, very much for joining me this morning. Informative conversation, so I thank the two of you very much.
Yeah.
And I've just got a minute or so to go here myself, and I wanted to let you know that tomorrow on the Dave Graham Show, we've got an interesting lineup as well. Peter Galbraith, former state senator from the southern part of Vermont, is going to be joining me. He has been in and out of government for a lot of his life, and he understands a lot about what's going on related to the impeachment inquiry in Washington. We're going to get a little review from Peter's perspective in the first half hour of the program tomorrow. Following that, Dick Sodick is going to update us on what's going on with Marlborough College. Big news there this week. And then we're going to have a discussion about genomic DNA testing being brought in by the University of Vermont Medical Center. It's going to be an interesting show tomorrow. I hope you tune in. Meanwhile, stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and have a great day, everybody.